Welcome to yet another episode of Creative Industry Radio. Today, I would love for you to meet David Grover of Capture One. As Global Head of Product Training, he serves the creative community with his broad knowledge of photography, post-production, and is the go-to guy on everything about Capture One. We share the same passion in working with images and in educating people in this amazing field. And we met in the year 2016 at Fotokina in Cologne, and we've been working together from that moment on. David invited me to join him in webinars and also made me become a global Capture One brand ambassador. And in this episode, we're sitting down to talk about David's life, his history in the creative industry, the development from analog to digital photography, the rise of working from home. We're talking about an iconic church in Iceland, and travel and frequent flyer tips. So get ready for some amazing hacks on actually spending less time queuing on airports. And of course, we're talking about Capture One as a powerful software for creatives and what it means to work in that amazing company. Are you ready to dive into this conversation with David? Cool. Then clean your lenses and let's bring it on. Usually it's you, David, that speaks the intro, but now it was my big pleasure to welcome you to the show, my friend. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. It's nice to have someone take over the management of an event. It's just nice that I can sit back and answer questions. This is the easy part.
Yes. So I thought it was just fair, you know, to
totally
turn sides. No, anyway. But for the few that don't know you, could you give the creative family a little background on who you are, where you live, and what you're doing?
Yeah, sure. So I've been working with Capture One for just over 10 years now. So I'm one of the old guard, because that's quite a long time for any company, I guess.
That's true, yeah.
When I say Capture One, I mean Capture One. There was a period before that where I was working for Phase One, but Phase One and Capture One are two separate companies now. So now I officially work for Capture One. And as you touched upon in the introduction, it's my job to lead up the education for the customers at Capture One, of which we have many, of course, and many diverse customers. And that could be in the form of live streams that you also mentioned. It could be tutorials, video tutorials. I work closely with my fantastic colleague, Jack, who's our technical writer as well. So he helps me out a lot with content too. And I'm part of a wider team. You know, I can't do my job without the rest of the team, of course, which is our customer success team, which is a large number of people dedicated to exactly that, making sure people experience success with Capture One, whatever that may be.
All right. And you said that you've been with Capture One for 10 years now.
Yeah.
So when we met, that was about, was it, if I calculated right, it was 3 years in? Was that correct?
Yeah, it probably sounds about right, I would think. When Fotokina was a thing.
Yeah,
of course.
It was still a thing.
So what year did you say?
I guess it was 16.
Yeah, that makes sense, I would think. Because I started in, just 2012, and I don't think I went to Fotokina that year. I don't believe. It makes sense that it was probably, 2014 or 2016. Yeah.
All right. And but you're not living and working in Copenhagen.
No. So I'm based out of the UK, which is more by accident or anything. The story behind that is that before working for Capture One, I was working for Hasselblad, which I'm sure people are aware of who Hasselblad is. And at the time of working for Hasselblad, and that's also another long story, then I was primarily employed to work in the UK, but that very quickly turned into a worldwide position. And it didn't really matter where I was, to be honest, because I was at the peak traveling 200, 220 days a year, something like that.
Oh.
So I could have lived in a box in a sea container or something. And it wouldn't have mattered. So, and that's just the way it's continued, really. So yeah, call me a pioneer from working from home, I suppose, but we're all a lot more used to it now than we were 5 years ago.
Oh, absolutely. But how was that shift for you when you stopped traveling that much?
It was all right, actually. I think there's a limit to how long you can travel to that extent and not die young, I would say. It's not particularly healthy flying that much in a 365 day period, I guess, and staying in hotels and eating nice hotel breakfasts and all those kinds of things, which aren't necessarily good for your health. So I still travel now, but to a lesser extent, and it's probably a really nice balance now. But I don't regret those years. I feel very privileged that I had traveled to all kinds of places that I never would have got to on my money. You know, essentially you're traveling on someone else's cash and ticket, which is yes, great. Yes, sure. I was working, but I still got to see places I probably never would have done.
All right. So, but now that you said that, what were the three most enjoyable places that you visited that you probably wouldn't have? And since you were traveling that frequently, I guess you could give great tips and tricks on for frequent flyers. So maybe you have got a top three there as well. That would be so amazing.
Well, I'd say that the most enjoyable places I've been to, it's always been Asia, I would think. South Korea in particular.
Okay.
Probably not somewhere I would have ended up now or thought about going to. But I love it. You know, I guess the one regret I have is that I haven't been to South Korea for a while because the food is fantastic, the people are nice. It's just a great place to visit. So if you get the chance to go to South Korea, do it and try all the foods. It just never stops coming. You sit down to dinner at South Korea and it's just a constant barrage of delicious things to eat, sometimes too much. And I don't know how they fit it all in because they're all, you know, obviously not a bit svelter than I am, and then they can pack away an amazing amount of food and it not show. So I'm jealous in that respect. So South Korea, definitely. Japan as well, because Japan is really so different than anywhere else, culturally, food-wise, technology, everything. It's an assault on the senses in a good way. I'd say probably the first time I went to Japan, I was maybe a bit shell-shocked as a relatively young person not experiencing that kind of a difference in culture when you've mostly traveled around Europe. But I love it there. I would frequently go back to Japan given the chance. Great people again, of course.
Nice.
Yeah, also for the food too. But then again, that was a learning experience, I guess, for a travel tip. It's not like I went to Japan and instantly embraced all the different food culture that there was. I would say it took me a couple of years to fully get into it. And now, it's probably one of the favorite things I like to eat as well. So if you can find a good Japanese restaurant, I'm there. And luckily, one just opened where I live, so which is rare because it's hard to find good Japanese places, especially in my local area. Yes, London, you'd be fine, but around here, not so much.
So how far away are you from London?
Not far. I'm only a 45-minute train ride, I guess. But
that's a lot for a lunch break.
Yeah, for a lunch break, not quite possible. But now I can have a Japanese lunch break, which
that's
is
amazing. And if you ever come to Düsseldorf, I'll take you to a really wonderful. Oh, there are many wonderful places because Düsseldorf has a quite large Japanese community.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
I heard it's one of the largest outside of Japan.
Okay.
So, yes, there are.
I wonder if that's due to, because isn't Fujifilm is based in Düsseldorf, and I think some of the other manufacturers
as well. Yeah, exactly.
And so maybe that's related.
I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
But anyhow, what do you have got any airport hacks for?
Airport hacks. you know what? It's always... Maybe this sounds too simple, but I'm always surprised at the number of people who don't check in early when they can. And then they get to the check-in desk and it's like, what do you mean I'm in a middle seat? It's like, well, because everyone else checked in 48 hours ago. Or even paying a relatively small amount to check in early and pick a seat can sometimes make a massive difference to a comfortable flight and an uncomfortable flight. Yeah, certainly if you're flying economy, don't leave it to the last minute.
That's a good one.
And don't try and carry too much on board. Right? That's a regular thing you still see. What do you mean I can't carry this huge bag on board? So those simple things can often pay big dividends. And even if you're in a big hurry, like London Gatwick, London Heathrow, and also Copenhagen Airport, they have the express lane for security. But quite often you can just buy your way into that. And it's not expensive either. So, for example, I think Gatwick is like £5 to jump the queue.
There's an option for that.
It's not crazy amounts of money. And then if it's a huge queue, that can make a massive difference, which at times has saved my bacon, shall we say, for getting on a flight, because sometimes the queue, normal queue, can be enormous and the premium one is practically empty. So London Gatwick Heathrow, it's £5 sterling to buy your way in, which is cheap compared to missing a flight. And I think Copenhagen, it's not much different either. And it's just nice, certainly after, if you've been working all day, the worst thing I hate now, maybe it's the age, I'm over queuing, even though I'm from the UK. I'm done with queuing for things. Yes. So any queue jumping can help along.
And you can, you know, you can spend that extra time having a nice pint somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. You can spend that time actually doing something enjoyable.
Yeah, that would have been nice. Actually, in Düsseldorf, they had this summer, last summer, they had this and hilarious situation where they had the two less staff, they said, and the people were queuing like for, I don't know, kilometers outside of the airport. Like, I'm a bit over exaggerating now.
Jeez, but really?
That was insane. And I don't know if they have that, but does it come with the is it like the package that you can buy for the lounges?
Maybe, yeah. I'm not sure.
I have to check that. Anyway, but you're working for a really, really interesting company, and you've got, I had the privilege to meet a lot of your colleagues, and they are super nice. And to set the mood a bit for our conversation today, I asked one of your wonderful colleagues, Xenia, for her impression of you to share with the audience. And if you don't mind, I would just give her the stage.
As long as it's good.
Listen.
Hi David, Xenia here. As a colleague, I value your honesty, your passion, and your dedication to teach our community about Capture One. But not just that, also teaching them about photography in general. I truly enjoy working with you, and I enjoy we can make each other laugh. I remember when you took over our Instagram while in Iceland with Paul Reifer, and I've told you to have fun. But I did not expect either S-curve dance move from you or you being a food critic on local snacks, but it was hilarious to watch. And not just that, laughter is important, and you're not shy of telling either a joke or writing something funny in our chats together. So I truly appreciate that. And, you know, even though we're in separate countries, you being in England, me being in Denmark, it never feels that way. It feels like we are so close of colleagues that, you know, distance doesn't matter anymore. And lastly, what I truly, truly love about you is that the crazy cat lady inside me and the cat that you are, that we can share knowledge about cats. So I just want to say thank you for being an amazing colleague. Thank you, David.
Nice.
Right. I thought that would be good to, you know, give a little feedback for you from your colleagues. And speaking of Capture One and your community there, as it seems that you're in a really good place there, you mentioned already that you started 10 years ago, but how did you get there in the first place, and why did you go there?
To Capture One?
Yes. So you said you came from Hasselblad, but what was the reason to make the transition?
It was relatively, not easy. I'm selling myself short. No, it's funny, the photographic industry in Scandinavia or Denmark, maybe in particular, it's really small, and maybe people don't realize how much an influence Denmark has had on professional photography, because this is where Phase One was born, of course. It's where Imacon was born, which you may or may not know that name. It's not a company that exists anymore, but Imacon was who I started working for, and when I started, which was 2002 at a guess, maybe, Imacon was a company that was making film scanners, so for scanning photographic film. So we're not that far in digital photography. It's still a relatively new thing when you think about it, because at the time there was still a market for people to buy a film scanner, which sounds completely crazy to say in 2023. But Imacon was started by a man, Christian Paulsen. Hi, Christian, if you ever listen to this, who also at a point in time worked at Phase One. There was also, at a point in time, Imacon bought another company called, what were they called? Color Crisp, which was another Danish company, which I think possibly had a vague link to Phase One or someone who worked at Phase One at some point. So Color Crisp was another company that made digital backs for putting on medium format cameras. They actually invented the multi-shot technology, which allowed you to move a sensor by 1 pixel per capture, mm-hmm. or a half pixel per capture, to build up a higher quality image. And now multi-shot technology, you see in Hasselblad cameras now, you also see it in Fujifilm cameras. I think Olympus perhaps also has Sony has a multi-shot technology anyway, but that was born out of some guy in Denmark making it somewhere. And there's also a bunch of people who have worked at Imacon, have worked at Phase One, have worked at Hasselblad, all these different companies. There was another company called ScanView, also based in Denmark, which has a lot of people, which then started working at Imacon and then Hasselblad and so on. So there was a whole lot of photographic technology that came out of Denmark and Sweden, which people probably don't realize. In actual fact, Hasselblad, who I ended up working for. So I started working for Imacon, but then the company that owned Hasselblad, or I'm going to get it the wrong way around now. The company that owned Imacon, Shriro, which was a company in Asia, like an import-export company, then also bought Hasselblad and merged Imacon and Hasselblad together. Which was a very interesting process, because in my naivety, I thought, Denmark and Sweden, they're practically next to each other, must be very similar cultures, this will go super smoothly. That's probably me thinking that merging an English and a French company would go super smoothly as well. So it was an interesting period, but it was a smart thing to do, because Hasselblad had camera technology, Imacon had digital back technology, but neither one had the other. So sticking those two halves together made perfect sense. So, but you could do a whole podcast on the history of Hasselblad and Imacon and so forth. But essentially how I got to Hasselblad, or how I got to Capture One, was that I had a very good colleague, Linda Paulsen, who I work closely with at Hasselblad. And then she moved over to Phase One. And then she took me with her, basically. So it was a poaching from one company to the other. But when I started, there was only 4 or 5 full-time people dedicated to Capture One, plus R&D, so plus the R&D engineers. But in terms of sales, marketing, social media, et cetera, there was just 4 or 5 of us. But I think in Capture One today, at last count, there is 170-something.
Wow. Okay.
With an R&D sites in Copenhagen and also in Athens. We have a great bunch of people in Greece. And we've got me in the UK, we've got a guy in France somewhere, hi Leon, Maria in Spain, Liz in the US, so it's very much an international company. And others I've probably forgotten spread around the world as well. Yeah.
It's an amazing development. And
it is. It really is rapid when you think of 10 years from 4 or 5 people to 170. That's pretty good growth, definitely.
Yeah. Let's see how it goes and where your next offices will open.
Yeah, who knows? Yeah, it was interesting the opening the office in Athens because we were always looking for a second site because Denmark's a small country.
Yeah, it's quite cold in the winter, so Athens makes sense.
Definitely, yeah. Like, I still haven't managed to get a visit over to Athens, so I need to do that.
You definitely need to, yes. I can recommend.
But there was always a good reason to look for a second site because, as I said, Denmark's a small country. It has hugely talented engineers. It has a great education system. But of course, it's sometimes hard to find, you know, there's not enough engineers to go around, I guess, all the different tech companies in Denmark. So it made sense to have another site somewhere.
Yeah. All right. So that got you there. And but if we go maybe to today, what's the biggest challenge you're facing in your role right now? And how are you tackling that?
Ooh, good question. I think that the biggest challenge, and I don't think this is a unique Capture One challenge. I think this is a unique, it's a typical learning a new software challenge. Because the biggest challenge we have right now, of course, is either to convince someone to switch to Capture One, which has always been a challenge, of course, because even if you are motivated to switch, it's pretty difficult to ask someone, forget everything you know about your current application, all your established workflows, you're going to drop that and you're going to pick up a new application, which we're telling you is better and we believe it's better for XYZ reasons. And then you've got to learn it all from scratch. And even though there's a whole bunch of common terms and methodology, which they may recognize, people generally don't like learning software. Unless you're a nerd like me or yourself or whatever, it's sometimes not a challenge you necessarily want to give to yourself. So onboarding, to use the kind of boring internal term, is something which has always been a challenge, either to get people to switch or to find new people as well, because there's plenty of great emerging photographers either coming out of education or who have had a career change from something completely different to photography. And those are the people that we want to capture as well, and also retain the existing client base as well. So that's three very different problems. So you've got retention, I guess, making sure that people can always get the best value out of Capture One, trying to convince people to switch over from other applications, which is tough because, let's face it, who wants to do that? Like if I said to you, Jan, let's switch you away from Photoshop to something else.
Yeah.
That would be a big, a big, big ask. But even if I found a really good application, and they probably exist as well, it's still a big ask because you've got so much muscle memory.
And I remember when I switched to Capture One, I guess it was, I don't know, maybe in 2011, 12-ish, something like that. It felt a little weird.
Yeah,
in the beginning, I had to get used to a completely new interface.
Yeah.
But overall, I think most of the things were pretty straightforward, but so that I could, you know, get started. But spending time with it and diving deeper into the possibilities, and especially having exchange with you or with the education offer that you had, or also with other people like Quentin, I'm still learning so much.
Yeah, me too.
All the time, and but it makes it so valuable to me that it has high switching cost, and that's a good thing from a marketing perspective and from a business perspective. So
Yeah.
Capture One did something right there.
Yeah. We know that you will get, you know, again, to use an internal term, like how quickly can you see the value in Capture One, regardless of what that is. Like it could be that it's much, much faster to tether than what you've experienced before, or it could be that it's much easier to manipulate colors than it could be before. But no two people are the same. Everyone has different... Everyone has a different aha moment or what triggers them to see the value. So trying to do that across a variety of different genres of photography and people needing to use it in different ways is the hardest challenge. But the good news is that we know we can improve on what we've got. So we can definitely make an impact to make people's lives easier. It's just not necessarily a speedy process, but it's a really good primary focus for a lot of us now, which is good. It was easier like 5, 6, 7 years ago. Pretty much Capture One was used in the studio by fashion and beauty and portrait photographers, and that was the customer base. So it was kind of easy to onboard people because you knew they wanted to tether in the studio. They probably wanted to work quickly and efficiently, of course, and do cool stuff on exporting or whatever, and yeah, probably less editing because that would be done by someone like you, at least to the finer points. But now we have wedding photographers, we have sports photographers, we have industrial photographers, architecture photographers, interior photographers who all need to do slightly different things. So it's definitely more challenging.
Well, the shift to digital, I think, was inevitable since it was established at some point. I recently saw the masterclass of Annie Leibovitz.
Oh, yeah.
And it was so amazing to see how she explained how she, you know, started working many, many years ago for Rolling Stone magazine and then shifted to produce all the fashion and campaigns for like Louis Vuitton and Vogue and everything, and how she had the transition to digital and what that meant to her. And she had the students around her since she was teaching at the Art Institute in San Francisco. And it was so amazing to see what kind of thoughts they had when turning to digital and what the benefits were, what the downsides were. And you can see in all the behind the scenes that she doesn't shoot tethered. And well, she shoots digital, but she doesn't shoot tethered. I think that they learned to be very, let's say, sure about what they do.
What they were doing. And I think that the only criticism I've heard of tethered shooting, I guess, is that then everybody has an opinion who's in the studio.
Yes.
So as if you get an instant, large, high-quality preview on screen, then the makeup artist can see it, the retoucher can see it, the photographer can see it, the client can see it. And then you've got four opinions that flourish instantly, whereas if someone like Annie is keeping the camera close to her chest and just shooting to the card, then it's like, well, yeah, let us import and choose the best ones and apply a look to it and do this and do that. Then, yeah, it gives them some control, but it's just not practical in 90% of situations.
But still, it's good to see, you know, like some artists, they keep the way they used to work, or they just don't want, as you said, I think that's the main reason not to avoid digital or like great software, but they want to have the control of what they're doing and not so many voices around.
Yeah, and as you say, it's a confidence to get it right. And I think I've seen some BTS of her shooting tethered, and I've seen this, you know, with a variety of people shooting tethered to get the baseline look, and then they pull the cable and tell everyone to go away and then shoot or shoot to card or literally hide the monitor so that no one can see it.
Yeah, then, I guess that can give the present people some confidence and then
creativity and then leave me to do my thing. Yeah. Thank you very much.
That's good.
Yeah.
So when you look back on your professional career, did you ever struggle? And what got you out of that situation?
Yeah, definitely. I think because the photo industry has been in various states of turmoil over the years, I suppose, or at least camera manufacturers and companies have had to find their feet. There's always been difficult periods, and I suppose Hasselblad had its fair share of that, really, and so did Imacon. All these companies had to transition pretty quickly over short periods of time. If you think Imacon was making tons of money selling film scanners, and almost in a very short period, that business was dead, if you like, because you could sell a few film scanners to people, but no one was going to invest 15,000 euros because these weren't cheap items either. It wasn't a $500 item. It was a, you know, 10 to 15, if not 30, if not $40,000 piece of equipment. So when it became clear that digital was a thing to here to stay, then of course a company like Imacon had to switch quickly to, okay, we need to provide digital capture services or systems as well. So there were some struggles where you think, oh, is my job on the line kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And that was also the case during Hasselblad's tenure as well. And it also doesn't help that there can be, and I don't think the photographic industry is unique in this, that there can be a lot of doom and gloom sometimes from the community. I've probably heard every year, you know, SLR cameras are finished or whatever, you know, everyone's going to shoot on iPhones or so on. And yes, I think the camera industry has changed a lot, and definitely you can see from sales statistics, I was looking at it today, that compact cameras, you can pretty much assume that no one's going to buy a compact camera anymore, at least not for pictures, maybe for vlogging or something like that, for sure. But there's a little glimmer of hope that in the end of 2022, the sales of interchangeable lens cameras, as they're beautifully known, actually went up a little bit. But also the cost of buying a camera has progressively gone up over the years as well. So anyone who's buying a DSLR camera or mirrorless camera is kind of pretty serious about photography, which is a good thing because it means that they're willing to spend money and time and invest in their hobby or profession or whatever. So it's also a case of weathering the storm, I suppose, because as I said, every year I've heard, you know, photography is dead, or raw photography is dead, or editing on a desktop is dead, or whatever. And Capture One still grows. And, you know, we have more staff, as I said, than we did 10 years ago. So,
yes. And you're pivoting, right? There's
Things
that pivot, are, you know, developing. And you came up with the iPad version. And I guess there's more coming. And
definitely.
People that can do the math know what we mean. And
yeah, we have to pivot. And I would also openly say maybe we've been a bit slow in the past to do that. But our CEO, Raphael, who's been with us a year now, has rapidly improved, you know, the rate at which we can develop and make sure that we're pivoting to serve what the customer needs, whether that's working on a interchangeable lens camera or something that sits in the hand like a mobile device or whatever, because iPhones and other high-end mobile cameras will become part of professional workflows, even if that's just for recce-ing or behind-the-scenes pictures, which are super important on social media and so on. And collaboration, of course, is more important than it's ever been, certainly remotely. We were very used to flying a bunch of people into a studio to work on a shoot, but that's less likely to happen now. You collaborate with your photographers remotely as well.
Yeah.
So with services like Capture One Live as well, that hopes to serve those kinds of workflows as well. But I think, yeah, really what's got me out of it, and I guess there were a couple of times where, let's think, I I haven't been fired yet, so that's something. But there were times when I thought, am I going to be fired?
Sure. Yeah.
Should I start being smart and thinking about going to a completely different industry? I did think about being an electrician at some point because I always enjoyed doing that. Thought these guys seem to earn good money. So there always seems to be impossible to get an electrician or a plumber. So maybe I should do that.
That's true. I think the demand will not flourish away.
No. Yeah, no, exactly. So that's my backup plan. Yeah.
That's a good one.
But I think it was a case of weathering the storm, keeping an eye on, also having confidence in who I was working for, that they would pivot, as you say. And to be honest, at the point of time when I left Hasselblad, I didn't have confidence that they were going to do that. And it was probably good timing when I left, when I did, as they did have a few pretty rough years. Now I can see, obviously, that they're doing much better. So really, that was what got me through it. Just weather the storm to some extent. Did it make sense to try and do something else? Try and look at the real facts and the data behind a lot of this doom and gloom stuff.
I guess that's kind of hard to do, right? So yeah. At least for many people, I guess. Like always having, you know, once people get comfortable in a situation, it's hard to think that how could I like change or go somewhere else?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the thing. I caught myself in that situation too. I guess it was, I don't know, 2007, 2008, around. I went self-employed in 2009.
Right.
But that was a decision that had to grow. And but then eventually I said, I don't have any real chance on taking the next step in that company.
Right.
Without any hard feelings, but it just wasn't possible at that time.
Yeah, exactly.
And I wanted to move on. And then I said, well, I'm going to do it myself. And that was...
Let's try. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. It was just, you know, the worst thing that can happen is that I find another job. But then a long journey of pivoting started. And it was worth it. But certainly it's not for everybody. And
No.
So that's what I meant. It can be hard to think about leaving a company that still gives you like the
stability
and your living expenses. And but yes, I think making that move will bring new perspectives, will new experiences, and will certainly make you grow as a person.
Definitely.
And
so
you did, and that was great.
Yeah, I've been lucky really that because this industry has changed so rapidly over the past 10-20 years.
Yeah.
I've never really had the same job year on year. I mean, it might look at it from the outside in, but other stuff that I get involved with internally is always changing. So I haven't got bored or anything like that, or felt I'm not giving value to the company or to myself or whatever. I guess that's more important in a way. And it's also, I've also fit into this working from home or working remote situation. And it was interesting to pick up on what Xenia said. You know, it doesn't feel like that we work remote, which is true because we're always chatting online to all of our colleagues. Fortunately, the technology has come on in that respect massively. Like I imagine anyone who is 22 years old or 25 years old now, it's part of daily life that you speak to colleagues online, whether that's chatting or video or something like that. When I think of my early days in Imacon and Hasselblad, and my internet was, I don't know, 3 megabits per second upload or something like that, you couldn't sustain a reliable audio or video call with anyone. So it's a case of, okay, you had a one phone call a week or something like that. And it was great. You got so much done. You were super productive because no one spoke to you during a whole day, but it was quite isolating, I suppose.
Yes. So it all has its pros and cons.
Definitely. There's a benefit to this world of communication that we live in now, but I guess the disadvantage is that you're never really left alone in a way.
Exactly. And I guess, I can say that when I'm zooming into an image like almost literally. And I can talk to other people in certain tasks, but when it comes to me wanting to focus, I enjoy that I can switch the rest of the world off.
Definitely, yeah.
And but I also found with the, things and situations that came with the epidemic, things changed.
Yes,
and
for sure.
I think for me, at least in the beginning, it felt like a relief to have got the permission to work at home, to spend time with my family, see my son every day, and and certainly everybody was able to like agree with that, and because everybody had to, right? And that was the I think that was a big catalyst for making that possible, and let's say commonly accepted.
Yes, and which is great because it is now commonly accepted. I think Capture One has a great working environment that generally someone can pop up and say, I'm working from home today, and that's fine. You know, it's not like, oh, you need to do X number of hours a week sitting in that same chair in the corner of the office. You know, it's very flexible. And I think people generally work better in that. They're happier. They probably work longer hours, to be honest. One of, not Hasselblad or Imacon or Capture One, but an older former employer, what they did that was very bad was put everyone on swipe cards, you know, logging when they stepped into the office and stepped out, which is normal for shift work or something where you're paid by the hour, but not on an office where people go into. But it soon backfired because everyone learned how to game the system and knew if they logged in 1 minute before they were due to start work and 15 minutes after, even if they did nothing at their desk for the last 15, 20 minutes, they could gradually build up all this extra holiday to the point where they had to stop it because people were getting like 50 days holiday a year or something like that. So it always backfires. And I guess if we can say a good thing about the pandemic was people's attitude to work-life balance.
Where was I?
Yeah, switched. Yeah, to then respect that time at home is not such a bad thing, and being a 12-hour days commuting and everything was often not the best way to spend people's time. So definitely being a positive thing. It's nice to still switch off the world every now and then. I don't know if I'd cope going back to an office full time. I'm too ingrained into sitting in my own little bubble. Unfortunately,
yes,
but I'm lucky that I can do that.
Absolutely. And now that we spoke about Capture One, your current situation, and being creative, and speaking of great images, and prior to the show, I asked you to please bring an image to the show. Because this is, I believe, a good way of connecting the audience on an emotional level with you.
Right.
And it would be very much appreciated if you would tell a little bit about that image that you sent me and why it means to so much to you, and what made it, what's the situation, and what were the feelings that you had when you were there in that situation?
Well, I picked it. It's a real cliched location. so that was part of the reason of picking of it. It's probably one of the most recognized churches in the world. If you don't recognize it, it's in Budir in Iceland. It's a little wooden church which sits out, I can't remember, the area in Iceland. I wouldn't be able to pronounce it anyway, so I just embarrass myself. But I was really lucky to be there at this time of year. And again, this is the privilege of being able to travel for work and go to all these fantastic locations. And not only travel, but also to be with people who can get the best out of that situation. So I was on a trip with one of our Capture One ambassadors, Paul Reefer. If you don't know Paul, he's an accomplished landscape, cityscape photographer. And at the period we were in Iceland, so this would have been, what was the date? Hang on.
Was in June.
Yeah, that makes sense. So at the time, we're lucky to have this phenomenon called midnight sun in Iceland. So the sun never really sets. It just dips to the horizon and pops straight back up again. So this was shot around midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning, something like that. I can't remember specifically, but it wasn't during the day. We'd been there during the day and I took a picture during the day, almost a very similar picture. And I was like, well, this looks pretty good. How can it really, like, are we really going to sit around for 12 hours waiting for the sun to set? Which we did. We went on a little excursion. We drove from the coast we were on up to the other side to a few other places and then came back. I mean, during the day, it's mobbed with tourists, of course. Like a lot of Iceland is now mobbed with tourists. It's a very accessible place, of course.
It's becoming a summer residence.
Yeah, exactly. It's easy to fly to from the US. It's actually pretty close. It's easy to fly to from Europe. It's not that expensive to get there. It's certainly expensive when you are there. But, it's an accessible place. I think I first went to Iceland with my mum and dad when I was 15. And we were real pioneers at that point for travel because Iceland was a really weird place to go for a trip. I was lucky enough to be with Paul and also in a situation where, as opposed to me teaching someone how to use Capture One, I was lucky to then have Paul to teach me how to get the best out of that situation, which was obviously to hang around until 1 o'clock in the morning. One of the advantages being no one else is stupid enough to hang around till 1 o'clock in the morning. So all the tourists that were there during the day, coach loads and everything that turned up, we were the only people there at 1 o'clock in the morning. So that was a good benefit.
There was no priest hanging out with
you? No priest hanging out. No, nothing. there was actually some activity going on in the church during the day, as you would expect. And they have a sign in the window saying, please do not peek in the windows or disturb what's going on inside. And of course, tourists ignore that. So the other part of learning with Paul was, of course, not only photographic technique, and I wouldn't have got that shot without him advising on all kinds of stuff. So that was a longish exposure as well. So he jerry-rigged some ND filters in front of the lens with gaffer tape. Always travel with gaffer tape. That's a good good tip.
That's a good one.
But also how to respect the landscape as well. So
yeah.
Not peeking in through windows, not hopping over gates that have no entry on them, which you see all the time in Iceland, unfortunately. Yeah. We are at another building, which is this really awesome house, which is kind of set into the side of this bedrock on a relatively flat bit of landscape. And it's really clearly signposted. This is private land, do not cross, etc. So we parked way back on a side road and took our shot from the side road with longer lenses, capturing this scene and everything, and then witnessed several people stop and park at the driveway to this house, jump over the fence, wander around it, take pictures, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. So part of, my education from Paul to me was, of course, how to respect the landscape so photographers don't get a bad name, the photographic technique and weather as well. I learned more about weather in those 4 or 5 days than I ever have done in the rest of my life, because we had a particular schedule to stick to or not stick to. Over 4 or 5 days mapped out which location we were going to, where we were going to stay, and all that kind of stuff. Nice. All of that was pretty much swept aside from day one because we were following the Icelandic weather service very closely and literally chasing pockets in the cloud, because the midnight sun is no use if it's cloudy. And on day one, it was thick cloud and it could have been nighttime, to be honest.
It sounds like a really great adventure.
Yeah, it was, and say really educational for me, which is why it stood out, because
So shout out to Paul.
Shout out to Paul, definitely. Yeah, I believe he's an amazing teacher. Know your weather systems, really. You'll take far better pictures if you're working outdoors, if you embrace the local meteorological websites and use tools to actually be in the right place at the right time. Church wouldn't look anything as nice as that under thick cloud.
And so, I'm really curious. So everybody listening, you can check out the image on the episode post to David's episode on the Instagram channel. And we're looking forward to your comments. Have you been there? Have you seen that church? And do you know it? And I wonder, how many people do fit inside? It looks really tiny.
It is tiny. Yeah, it is tiny. I went back there actually a few... let's think, when did I go there? End of September, which was on I was piggybacking on a workshop course with a company called Way Up North, which do wedding events for wedding photographers. And we actually took a wedding couple to that same church. That's actually the last post on my Instagram as well. And that was quite funny because some people were so happy to see a wedding. They're like, oh, congratulations on your wedding. They hadn't got married. They were a fake. I think they were actually married, but it wasn't their wedding. So it was just a couple that were hired in for the shoot. But people were so happy to see a married couple congratulating them and everything. It's a great, great location. But if you do go, then go in the summer and go there at 1 o'clock in the morning.
That's amazing.
And follow the weather.
Thank you for sharing this. that's a really cool picture and an even better story around it. Hey, I want to go to the a bit more interactive part with the episode. And there's a little tradition that I always ask my guests to ask one question to the next guest.
Okay.
And without knowing who it is. So for you, you actually know who it is, but it was Quentin. Quentin Descaillet, another ambassador colleague of mine, and of course, a longtime fellow working with you. And Quentin asks, without knowing that it's going to be you,
okay,
if you could go back in time, just right before COVID hit in 2020, and you could change something that would make your career or work better, what would it be and how would you make it happen?
Ooh, so if we could go back in time, yeah.
So was there anything... that you can think of now that you could have done with it not happening?
Yeah,
to probably. Make your work or career better.
Yeah, I think when 2020 hit and then we were all stuck at home, we had to rapidly think, okay, so we used to do quite a lot of events, photographic events, trade shows, all that kind of stuff, which, to be honest, haven't really quite bounced back yet. They are bouncing back. And I think this year it's probably back to normal. So we very rapidly thought, how do we do events or how do we live stream, to be really specific, because we didn't kind of knew how to do it a little bit, but not in a super professional way. So we had to learn very rapidly how to do, you know, go live to YouTube, go live to Facebook or whatever. I'd had a lot of experience of doing a live broadcast to a closed audience. But that was very different from a proper production with decent audio and me on screen and intro pages and outro pages, all that kind of stuff. So if we'd had figured that out beforehand, because that was just slackness on my part, not doing it better in the first place, then that would have made that, then we would have been ahead, you know, like, well, yeah, we know how to do this. It's just same as business as usual. So
that's a good point.
Predicting that trend maybe would have made our life easier, definitely.
Well, fair enough.
Yeah. So then it was a case of, oh, how do we do this? And luckily I have to give another shout out to Frederick of This Week in Photo, who was also a bit of a pioneer at that point in trying to figure out live streaming stuff. And we tried a whole bunch of different platforms and so on. Some worked, some awful. some okay. So with his help and discovering a few other applications, then yeah, we nailed it. And then also Paul again as well, because he was in this boat of, well, I can't travel. How am I going to not go bored to death? Because Paul is still a prolific traveler and his business is based on traveling to places and shooting cities and landscapes. So also between me and Frederick, and then also Paul at a later date, we managed to figure that out. But it would have been useful to know how to do that beforehand, that's for sure.
Excellent. Hey, I have got a question from the creative family for you that I would love to just play. So I asked the community before, and I always pick one question for the guests. And this one's from Jesse. So here she goes.
Hey, Jan and David. I would like to ask a question. From where do you get inspiration for new looks for an image? And also, how do you decide which look suits the best for a certain picture? Thanks.
New looks, eh? Hmm. So I think for me, and it's definitely easy to get stuck in a bit of a rut in terms of, okay, this is the way I edit, or this is the colors palette I go for. Yeah, and so on. So I think where I've looked for inspiration is probably, again, other people as well. And I did a task once where I forced myself to edit something in four completely different ways, like my normal vanilla way, if you like, how I would probably approach it, and then try to do that completely in a different style. And that was a really worthwhile exercise, actually. And also to give another shout out to a photographer, a friend of the family, Emily Teague as well. She's always had some good tips on color grading and different looks and everything. So she's my go-to to kind of drag me out of a rut as well. And she's always had some good resources, which I won't remember now without looking them up. But also following what, these are resources from Emily, following how color grading is looking in motion picture or popular series on the streaming services and so on, and looking at what color palettes they use and trying to draw inspiration from that. So that's, I think, has been helpful to me and hopefully helpful to others as well.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And maybe if you should find that that link
of
Emily, we can share that in the show notes. That would be amazing.
Yeah.
All right. So I would love to take a little look into the future of the creative industry with you.
Okay.
And before we go to the quick fire questions, and since there's a lot of discussions about how the creative industry, and especially, of course, photography or the all things like graphic design and so on, will be in like 5 to 10 years, which is very hard to predict, I'd say.
Yes.
But I get asked a lot if I'm afraid of emerging technologies affecting the creative industries, like artificial intelligence, intelligence changing the value chains for creative content, etc. And I always say, no, not really. But how do you feel about that?
I think a little bit, I guess. I think from a philosophical or emotional standpoint, I think it would be really nice to keep the arts away from the robots, if that makes sense. Like, can we please keep something that doesn't get created by a machine? Like, I think that the technology is super impressive. If we're talking about, you know, the likes of Midjourney and so forth,
like, absolutely,
I'm definitely impressed with what it can do, and I've tried it. But what I'll say from my personal standpoint is that it leaves me completely emotionally cold, if that makes sense. So yes, I can go in, I can prompt a few words or several words and get an output, but I have absolutely zero emotional connection with that, because I don't feel like I played a prominent role in the creation of it. So
yeah, but I don't feel that's you, right, as the creator.
Yeah.
But how about the people that see the creative?
Well, I guess those that see it are none the wiser. And if you say to them, this was built by AI or this was built by an artist, would they care? Some people would, yes. Some people might not. Like, I would never consider investing any sum of my own money into an AI created art piece, no matter how fantastic it was, because part of owning the art piece is that you own a little piece of the artist, I suppose, if that makes sense. Like, I don't own a lot of original artworks, but I own some, not by hugely prolific artists. But I own probably like 1, 2, 3. Well, we've got some cool little like Canadian snowscapes drawn by a Canadian artist who's now died, unfortunately. But they have immense value to me because that's the only one that exists in the world of this art piece. And we enjoy looking at it. You know, it's a great piece of art. If that was built by a computer, would I care about it so much? Definitely not. And to be honest, I've built, you know, 2 or 3 pieces in something like Midjourney, and I never went back to it since because I did not find... I'd rather take a crappy photo than make something amazing in Midjourney, if that's a good comparison.
Yeah, I understand your point. Yeah. But I guess we are at a very interesting point in the development of that. So it just started practically.
Yeah, so pretty much.
And what it does already, what it's capable of already, is kind of mind-blowing.
Yes.
And if you see what other AIs are out there, like ChatGPT, is it?
ChatGPT.
GPT, yep. That's, yes. If you see something like that, or if you see that there is text to video already and things like that. So if we take a look into like the next 5 year or like where are those technologies in 5 years? It's so hard to imagine.
Yeah.
And but what I like to think about is, what if all the tedious work in editing images or creating designs would be dealt with AI?
Yeah.
We could be left with the creative part and making it unique. And whenever I get asked about AI, it's interesting that you say that you lack the emotions in it or like the emotional connection with it. I kind of feel the same. But if you imagine that it's going to be another tool in your pocket or in your tool stack. For example, if you go back like 10 years working in a creative design agency or in an advertising agency, I remember very vividly that we had those illustrators create mood boards for us or moods of a certain campaign idea. And they worked on it for a day or two and sent back the scribble charts.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's dead now.
Possibly, yeah.
You don't need that because you can illustrate an idea very, very vividly with that. And it takes a minute or maybe an hour with a lot of changing the prompts. But so that being said, I guess we can concentrate on the positive sides of that because it's inevitable. What's the word? Inevitable.
Inevitable. Yeah.
That it goes away. It won't go away. It will.
No, it won't go away.
It will only get better and better.
Yeah.
And I guess now the discussion about intellectual property is very important. And I guess that will lead to changes that will make it more acceptable in the end.
Yeah.
Well, I guess you know that I created a series. I created a series of images where AI created elements were used in photography. So I tried to combine that with Ava. And so I didn't want to, you know, just create the image only in Midjourney, but I thought about how can we make use of that?
Yeah.
And how can we create something unique out of this using the tool it gives us? And I like to always see the chances rather than the threat.
Yes.
Because if you are ahead of that, and then I guess you can make use of any new technology.
Yeah.
And it has always been like that.
I definitely think getting ahead of it makes sense. And I think, as you say, if it can find a home to relieve some of the tedious elements, then that would be a win for me. I think in photo editing, then to have an AI just edit your photo isn't interesting for me per se, because that's part of the process. But it could be interesting for, I don't know, getting rid of some of the tedious stuff, like you say, like finding all the pictures that are out of focus. That's a great AI task.
Absolutely.
Finding all the pictures where someone's got their eyes closed, or finding all the pictures that are similar and then picking the best one or whatever, which part of that's already possible in Capture One. But I think the more AI can do the boring stuff for you and do it well.
Exactly. It saves
then
your
more time.
Time
you get to do the fun stuff. I guess the danger is that because people, or often the people buying creative services, don't necessarily see the value in the creative service, this could be a way to diminish some of the work that's available. Like a friend of mine recently, and she turned around by someone else's advice, which was good. It was just something stupid like buying a school picture of the kids. And of course, traditionally you would buy prints and you would pay quite a lot of money for the prints.
Yes.
I don't know if that's a thing in Germany with school pictures, but
it is
big here, and it's big in the US.
I think it's a
example.
Big industry.
It's a huge, huge industry. I think in the UK there's a massive company. I think there's probably two or three companies which pretty much serve the entire country. But she was upset because they wanted to charge whatever, 20-something pounds, euros, dollars for the download. So I'm not paying that for just a download, until her friend said, well, don't think of the material costs. Think of what the value is to have a picture of your kids at this point in their life. And like, oh yeah.
Yes. Yeah, and
that made them pivot. Yeah, exactly. But I think, you know, to round up my thoughts on AI, I think, yeah, it'd be really nice if it got rid of some of the tedious stuff. I just hope that it's not the de facto way for a company to then get their output. But what it might do on the flip side is that it might increase the value of handmade creative output, if that's a word, in the same way that people now value artisan built products or whatever, as opposed to mass produced. So maybe it will increase the value of traditional techniques and so on.
Yes. And there's many pros, and there's a lot of cons, actually.
Yep.
So it's, you know, I'm very curious to see what happens. But there's also some things that I really observe with a worried eye a bit.
Yep.
Is that there is so much pressure, obviously, on people that show themselves online on Instagram or whatever platform, and they kind of see the need to change their appearance with AI-driven technology, like face apps or something like that.
Yeah.
And that leads to an ethical discussion, I think.
Yeah.
Especially in advertising, but also in a whole social world. I recently worked on a beauty series, and something really strange happened. So the picture was sent out, and it came back from the model, actually. And she said that, I changed this and that on myself with a face app. And could you please change that? I was like, I don't know. Of course I could, but where does that lead to? Like, first of all, it's the image by the photographer.
Yeah.
Right? And there is a certain creative idea behind that. And why would we, as a duo of photographer and retouch artist, why would we change the face of the model, like, to something that is not real?
Yeah, it doesn't resemble
or not
them.
Real at all.
Yeah.
You know, there's always things that you do, and I'm a big fan of not doing too much. But it always is always a question of the brief in the end. But if you see that from the professional world happening, and then you go to the world of everybody, because there are so many people having mobile phones with a camera, taking images of themselves, and many of those apps, they change the face by default.
Yeah.
And why? Why is that?
Yeah. Why is smartphones? It's you can't turn off. Yeah, filtering or whatever, you end up with zero skin texture. Come up with
is what it should look like. Mm-hmm. I think that's something that goes way too far, and I hope that there's a lot of discussion about that. And that's one thing that I want to point on especially in that podcast and when I speak somewhere on stage or so. It's so important to talk about the ethics of retouching.
Yes. Yeah. For sure.
And photography, that is kind of just because the technology
which I'm
is there.
Glad is a conversation that comes up now, because I guess in the past, it was almost de facto that things would get a lot of retouching, and there seems to be a little bit more awareness around it now, mostly because of the psychological effect that it can have on men, women, of all ages.
Exactly.
Like, wow, is that what I'm supposed to look like? I don't look like that. Yeah,
yeah, and nobody does. Yeah.
Nobody does. No.
But there is the development that images come to the retouch artist and they say, use slimmer face 2 and face color 3. Okay.
Yes. So
what? Okay.
What? Yeah.
Really? Okay. That's what you want. That's interesting.
Yeah.
So anyhow, last question before we go into the Q&A. The quick fire questions, that we spoke about the future. What do you think is the most valuable skill a creative professional or a creative amateur must have in 23?
It's going to sound cliched, but it's probably not their creative skills. I've certainly met plenty of hugely talented creative people that haven't been successful because they don't have the requisite marketing skills or business skills or whatever. And I'd probably be one of those people as well. Like, it's all very well to be able to take a great picture, retouch an amazing picture, paint a fantastic picture. But I suppose if you can't generate awareness about your skill, then it doesn't matter how skillful you are with your creativity. I think the hardest part is actually the business management side of it. So if you can school up on that, and your communication skills, and even your I guess quoting skills, those kinds of things are going to sound like a very specific thing, but in terms of when I've had dealings with creatives that we want to commission for various things, quite often people get too obsessed with, I need to be the cheapest or whatever, or the most flexible. Definitely not. Like, being the cheapest doesn't necessarily win.
No. There's always someone that wants to go bankrupt faster than you.
Yeah, definitely. There will always be exactly the next person in line who is even cheaper. But it's just, I guess, making the client's life as easy as possible. So if you've got a fantastic quote with everything itemized, if you deliver on the day and go that extra mile on the day, so be it. If your invoicing is on point and all those kinds of really boring business things certainly seem to be a lot more value than the creativity. But it's the really hard part, I guess, generating awareness about how fantastic you are is a really difficult skill. So anything you can do to improve that, I think is money well spent.
Absolutely. And I think one thing you said, I totally agree with, actually I agree with everything, but one thing in particular was that communication skills. And as you are a very talented educator also, and you're doing that for a long time already. Mm. I think that's one very important thing is, I guess, being willing to give right? Being willing to give knowledge, provide feedback, connect people, and especially motivate and empower them to grow and to let them know they are not alone is definitely one thing that can make the difference in being perceived as an artist and as a professional by many people, because there are so many, as you said, that are really talented, but if nobody sees you or sees the value that you bring to the creative family or community, I guess that's one thing that I found is very important to show that you are willing to share a bit of your expertise, and that you are just a giving person makes such a big difference in how you're perceived. Because if you put it all together, creative services, it's a people's business.
It is. It's very much a people's business. So how you communicate, interact, collaborate is as important, if not more important, than your output. And I think people will probably, even if you are like the best photographer, painter, retoucher, or whatever, it doesn't matter if you're the best. If you're difficult to work with in some aspect, if I can be,
let's put it that way. Correct. Yes.
Yeah. Then it doesn't matter. Then you don't get repeat commissions. But anything you can do to make the client's life easier, which could be a really broad way to say it, is pays dividends. But it's really difficult. I don't envy any creative having to advertise themselves, because we tend to be as creative a little bit, you know, introvert sometimes, and not wanting to blow our own horn, etc. To then actually come out and say, you need to hire me because XYZ is quite challenging.
You're absolutely right. But from having been there, I can tell you, or everybody, of course, is that you don't need to be the best to be able to talk about what you do. And you don't have to be alone in that situation. Because when I was starting out, or when I was, you know, emerging, getting better and better, and I still didn't know when good was good enough, or when I had some very unsure moments. So what I did was I eventually opened up and searched for people in a better position, like being there where I wanted to be, and just ask for feedback and for, you know, just having conversations about things that I had to deal with in my day to day. And that gave me so much more confidence and peace of mind, actually, to be able to discuss what is good and how to deal with a situation where, for example, a client doesn't answer for a certain time.
Yeah.
It's not... Yes. Most of the times, there's nothing behind it. It's just they are busy with something else, or your project is not that important for them at the moment. But it's mostly never about you personally. But I had the tendency to think that. I don't know why, but it happened. And so, you know, speaking about it, being open, finding your circle of trust, and then, you know, going that way together with someone, doesn't matter how many, but that certainly led to more development, more creative output, and especially more motivation. And I guess that's, to close it with, that's what I see, what you said with communication skills and being open and also sharing bits and pieces of your thoughts, because there are so many that are in the same situation.
Definitely.
And as you said, they creatives can be introverts, but there is no need to be shy about things. You know, shy isn't a thing, actually, I think. it's something that you might believe in, but actually you don't have to be shy if you don't want to. And that's about a decision that you can take.
Yeah. Anyhow. And I would say don't be shy about your business practices as well. Like something that I've also experienced a lot being on the buying end is, you know, lack of robust contracts or whatever. And that could equally be on our side. But I've seen firsthand many times where something has gone wrong. And it's like, well, what's in your contract? Oh, I don't have a contract. It's like, and often we hear, well, I didn't want to scare them off with a big, scary legal contract or something like that. I mean, to corporations, contracts are not scary at all. It shows that you've got your, you know, bases covered, you're actually got a professional mindset about delivery and so on. So never think about having good, tight contractual, I will deliver on this day, you will pay me this much. If you cancel, you pay me this, you know, all that kind of stuff, which people think is frightening, is really not. Like, get all that stuff tied up, because if I'm looking for someone and I want to commission them for something, then it's a joy to see terms and conditions come back that are really clear. Not that sounds great, let's work together and yeah, call me kind of thing.
You're absolutely right. Yeah. And I guess that's a mistake that many people do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Especially
so
when starting
tight contracts
out.
is a joy to behold, even though it might not seem it.
Yeah. And when something happens, it's always good to have that agreed on before.
Yep, totally.
All right, that was perfect. Very valuable. And thank you for that. So let's jump into the quick fire questions for everybody to have some real take-home value instantly. And I'm just going to go through the questions with you very quickly. You answer in a short sentence or two, whatever you want. And I'm just going to start with the first one. What would be your statement if you could put one on a large billboard?
Oh, God, that's a difficult one to answer quickly. My statement would be on a large billboard. Our steal Nike slogan, just do it.
That's great.
I think we spend too long worrying about stuff, so just do it. Yeah.
What is your favorite fun hobby?
Favorite fun hobby? I would say, you know, in a former life, if I had the time, and again, I would do something with my hands. So like woodworking, metalworking, anything like fabrication of any kind.
What could be, what could the next generation do better than you?
Embrace diversity, I would say, wherever that comes. Yeah.
What would you love for your peers to say about you on your 80th birthday?
On my 80th birthday. He had a good time. That sounds more like an obituary.
What is easier for you to say no to today than a few years ago, maybe?
Work tasks, which sounds really bad. But I think there a point in time when you're working in any company, you can fall into the habit of saying yes to anything. And that's not necessarily a good thing. So it's a case of, yes, I can do that, or no, I can't do that, because then I can't do this other thing for you. So
yeah,
make a choice. So better at prioritizing, I suppose, or making other people prioritize what they want you to do. Yeah.
That's a good one. Actually reminds me of a sentence that I recently read, that is, a yes to someone can be a no to yourself.
Yeah.
Or the other way around, a no to someone can be a yes to yourself.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. So yeah, don't forget to say no sometimes.
What or who inspires you? Is there anything like a resource that you frequently go to, or someone that you've met over the course of your career, or an artist that you really enjoy as a resource of creativity?
I think the problem with me, I enjoy so much, so it's difficult to say this particular person.
Or website or anything?
Yeah.
or a book?
Let's think. I'd say in a general thing, I'm always inspired by people, and that could be anyone. It could be a famous person. It could be someone I know who make brave choices that I wouldn't be good at, like we're going to move to a different country or something like that. Yeah, we're bored of living here. We're going to up sticks and move from the UK to Australia or something like that. So I'm always inspired by people who make those choices, which I think I would struggle to do. And then over the years, I suppose that's helped me make some of those choices that I, you know, would have shied away from in the past. So, and that could be a number of people I look up to. So yeah, inspired by those making the tough decisions, I think.
All right. What are your three favorite apps on your smartphone?
My three favorite apps. Let's see. Just looking at what I've got. Oh, what was that awesome one I found the other day? God, it's mixed into the big mess about. Oh, here we go. There it was. So yeah, recently after a little bit of ill health recovery, I discovered Calm.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
It's a meditation app.
Oh. Yeah, so it's if you want to have, you know, Matthew McConaughey reading you a bedtime story or whatever, that's the place to go. So that it was interesting. I found that really helpful for just restfulness, getting to sleep, that kind of stuff when I was less than comfortable and so on. So that was a good one. I would say my collection of various different smart home apps.
Oh,
because the home here is very connected. So again, this is AI doing stuff which is tedious. So various lighting, heating, you know, audio functionality or whatever. So which Perfect. Is happily working for me in the background.
We're going full circle here.
Full circle. Yeah, exactly. And then I guess from what else am I looking at regularly? Wouldn't, if I would call that a favorite, my bank has a really good app, but but again, that takes the mundane things.
You've got a lot
things.
Of good invoice, and when it gives you the notification.
Yeah, exactly.
what's the bank?
Starling, which is one of these newer banks, which have sprung up since all the traditional high street banks here are just closing. Not closing, but just closing branches because they say people don't visit us anymore. I said, well, they didn't because no one could leave home for 2 years. And then you reduced the hours. So now everyone gave up visiting to banks. But anyway, but it's been great in that respect. So I'd say Calm is a good one. Smart home stuff doing tedious things for you. And from a health perspective, I have a few things from a company called Withings, mm-hmm. which does various different health monitoring stuff, and that's always good.
I remember
to see how the body is doing.
Yeah, I remember that we have a scale at home.
Yes, yep.
It's quite old, actually, like 10 years maybe,
mm-hmm.
and it has the connection to the smartphone.
Yeah, it
tells
so
you
can be
how
reminded
you
of
developed.
How badly you're doing or how well you're doing.
Yeah, exactly. So last one of the quick fire questions is, mm-hmm. what makes you happy?
What makes me happy? I guess because I spend a large proportion of the week, you know, indoors in the same place or whatever, just being outside. And it doesn't matter what I'm doing. If I'm outside, I'm generally happy. So, yeah, being outdoors. And maybe that's a bit of a cliched answer, but it is genuinely true. Being outside is a big thing for me. And doesn't have to be good weather either. I operate better in cooler climates than I do in hotter climates. So, yeah,
that's
being outdoors makes me happy.
That's a very good one,
definitely.
I think. Yeah. All right, so we closed the show actually almost because there's always three questions in the end, that my guest gets to ask. And I would love for you to ask one question to the creative family.
Okay.
If you don't mind. And that they can answer below your episode post.
Okay. So let's think. So other than AI technology, what would make your life easier?
I'm very curious what what answers would come.
Yeah.
And
because then I'm going to use those answers to make my life easier as well.
That's great.
Because we all have great hacks. So
I guess that's a win-win situation everybody. Exactly. So please reach out
other
and
than
answer
AI technology,
answer that question because easier. It's a great one.
Yeah.
What would be your question for my next guest?
But we don't know who that is. No.
Yes.
It's a secret. Okay. What is the most valuable skill you learned other than your primary creative skill?
Looking forward to that as well.
And it could be anything. Doesn't have to be work-related. It could be I'm an expert, I don't know, bottle opener or something.
Well, I met some really nice bottle openers recently. They two really, really cool barkeepers from Luxembourg, actually.
There we go.
Very skilled guys. So, and thanks to you, I guess so many things have happened in my career that you probably don't know of, but I wanted to send my gratitude your ways as well because you opened...
Feeling is mutual.
Thank you. You opened many doors for me, and it's really appreciated that you took me into the Capture One family officially.
You're welcome. But we have to say other apps are available, of course.
Yes, they are. You can try, but remember, buying cheap is buying twice.
That's right.
In the end. So
something I never learned.
Is there a way the audience can reach you? Like the obvious channels? LinkedIn,
obvious channels. So
Instagram.
I guess Instagram is my main channel. I'm not the most regular poster, but I'm a regular viewer. So yeah, I'm on Instagram. It's just _ and my name. So it's easy to find. Yeah.
And we will link your contact options in the show notes.
Yeah, sure.
And is there anything the listeners can do for you?
What can they do for me?
Maybe show up on your next
webinars. Yeah, show up on the next live stream. always good for the numbers, yeah. And well, what they can do for me is, I guess, any super valuable image editing tool that they need that they don't have, or collaboration tool or anything like that, you know, let us know what would make a big difference to their workflow that isn't provided right now.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be photo editing. It could be studio management. It could be location finding or whatever. What is the big pain that would be nice to be relieved?
Wonderful.
Yeah.
So, David, thank you so much for the time you took and for being my guest today. It was very, very nice to have that deep conversation about various topics and getting to know you a bit more personally.
A pleasure.
For the audience to know who you are, what you do, and where you came from, where you're going. And it was a true pleasure talking to you, as always.
Likewise. Hope they stayed awake.
Whoever made it to the end.
Yep. Good job. Well done.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jan. Take care.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Creative Industry Radio. I hope you enjoyed today's conversation and took away some valuable insights into the creative industry. I'd love to hear from you and to continue the conversation, so make sure to leave a comment on the respective show episode post on Instagram and LinkedIn. and let us know what you think about the image and the story to it that was shared. And of course, you're welcome to answer the question of today's guest. And if you liked what you heard today and found value in it, why not share the love and forward this episode to a friend or colleague who could also benefit from the content? Your support means the world to me, and a subscription to this podcast would be greatly appreciated. So, until next time, keep being creative and stay tuned for more episodes of Creative Industry Radio. This is your host, Jan, signing off.